Son resembled his father, except he was a little more contemporary. He had extremely closely cropped hair, a tiny gold stud in his ear. She looked at the caption. Here he relaxes on the beach at Lantern Island with his wife, Soon, and his children, Erica and Tom. In front of the family, a blue towel was spread across the sand. Nearby, a wicker picnic basket with blue-checked cloth peeking out. The scene was mundane and uninteresting. Why would anyone fax this to her? She looked at the date on the magazine, January, 3 months ago. But someone had had a copy of that magazine and had faxed it to Casey. Who? An employee of the airline? A passenger? Who? And why? What was it supposed to tell her? As Casey looked at the magazine picture, she was reminded of the unresolved threads of the investigation. There was a great deal of checking still to do, and she might as well get started. Norma was right. Casey didn't know what Marta was up to, but maybe it didn't matter, because her job was still the same as it had always been, to find out what happened to Flight 545. She came out of the office. "Where's Richmond?" Norma smiled. "I sent him over to Media Relations to see Benson, pick up some standard press packets in case we need him."
"Benson's got to be pissed off about this," Casey said.
"Uh-huh," Norma said. "Might even give Mr. Richmond a hard time." She smiled, looked at her watch. "But I'd say you've got an hour or so to do what you want, so get going."
NAIL, 3:05 p.m.
"So, Singleton," Ziegler said, waving her to a seat. After 5 minutes of pounding on the soundproof door, she had been admitted to the audio lab. "I believe we found what you were looking for," Ziegler said. On the monitor in front of her, she saw a freeze frame of the smiling baby sitting on the mother's lap. "You wanted the period just prior to the incident," Ziegler said. "Here we're approximately 18 seconds prior. I'll start with full audio and then cut in the filters. Ready?"
"Yes," she said.
Ziegler ran the tape. At high volume, the baby's slobbering was like a bubbling brook. The hum inside the cabin was a constant roar. "Taste good?" the man's voice said to the baby very loudly. "Cutting in," Ziegler said. "High-end bypass." The sound got duller. "Cabin ambient bypass." The slobbering was suddenly loud against a silent background, the cabin roar gone. "High delta V bypass." The slobbering was diminished. What she heard now were mostly background sounds, silverware clinking, fabric movement. The man said, "Is at breakfast, or you, Era?" His voice cut in and out. "Delta V bypass is no good for human speech," Ziegler said. "But you don't care, right?"
"No,"
Casey said. The man said, "Not aiding or urdis is on, I." When the man finished, the screen became almost silent again, just a few distant notes. "Now," Ziegler said, "it starts." A counter appeared on the screen. The timer ran forward, red numerals flickering fast, counting tenths and hundredths of a second. The wife jerked her head around. "What? What at?" She could hear it now. A low rumble, a definite shuddering bass sound. "It's been thinned by the bypass," Ziegler said. "Deep, low rumble, down in the 2 to 5 hertz range, almost a vibration." No question, Casey thought. With the filters in place, she could hear it. It was there. The man's voice broke in, a booming laugh. "Take it easy, Em." The baby giggled again, a sharp, ear-splitting crackle. The husband said, "Oh, om, honey." The low-pitch rumbling ended.
"Stop," Casey said.
The red numerals froze. The numbers were big on the screen. 11:59:32. Nearly 12 seconds, she thought. And 12 seconds was the time it took for the slats to fully deploy. The slats had deployed on Flight 545. By now the tape was showing the steep descent, the baby sliding on the mother's lap, the mother clutching it, her panicked face. Passengers anxious in the background. With the filters in place, all their shouts produced unusual clipped-off noise, almost like static. Ziegler stopped the tape. There's your data, Singleton. Unequivocal, I'd say.
The slats deployed.
Sure sounds like it. It's a fairly unique signature.
Why?
The aircraft was in cruise flight.
Why would they deploy?
Was it uncommanded, or had the pilot done it? Casey wished again for the flight data recorder. All these questions could be answered in a few minutes if they just had the data from the FDR. But it was going very slowly.
Did you look at the rest of the tape?
Well, the next point of interest is the cockpit alarms, Ziegler said. Once the camera jams in the door, I can listen to the audio and assemble a sequence of what the aircraft was telling the pilot, but that'll take me another day.
Stay with it, she said. I want everything you can give me.
Then her beeper went off. She pulled it off her belt, looked at it. Star, star, star. J.M. Admin. ASAP. B-T-O-Y-A. John Martyr wanted to see her in his office now.
Norton Administration, 5 p.m. John Martyr was in his calm mood, the dangerous one.
Just a short interview, he said. 10-15 minutes at most. You won't have time to go into specifics, but as the head of the IRT, you're in the perfect position to explain the company's commitment to safety. How carefully we review accidents, our commitment to product support. Then you can explain that our preliminary report shows the accident was caused by a counterfeit thruster cowl installed at a foreign repair station. So it could not have been a slats event. And blow Barker out of the water. Blow Newsline out of the water.
John, she said, I just came from audio. There's no question the slats deployed.
Well, audio's circumstantial at best, Martyr said. Ziegler's a nut. We'll have to wait for the flight data recorder to know precisely what happened. Meanwhile, the IRT has made a preliminary finding which excludes slats.
As if hearing her own voice from a distance, she said, John, I'm uncomfortable with this.
We're talking about the future, Casey.
I understand, but
the China sale will save the company. Cash flow, stretch development, new aircraft, bright future. That's what we're talking about here, Casey. Thousands of jobs.
I understand, but
let me ask you something, Casey. Do you think there's anything wrong with the N-22?
Absolutely not.
You think it's a death trap?
No.
What about the company? Think it's a good company?
Of course.
He stared at her, shaking his head. Finally, he said, there's someone I want you to talk to.
Edward Fuller was the head of Norton Legal. He was a thin, ungainly man of 40. He sat uneasily in the chair in Martyr's office.
Edward, Martyr said, we have a problem. Newsline is going to run a story on the N-22 this weekend on primetime television, and it's going to be highly unfavorable.
How unfavorable?
They're calling the N-22 a death trap.
Oh, dear, Fuller said. That's very unfortunate.
Yes, it is, Martyr said. I brought you in because I want to know what I can do about it.
Do about it? Fuller said, frowning.
Yes, Martyr said. We feel Newsline is being crudely sensationalistic. We regard their story as uninformed and prejudicial to our product. We believe they are deliberately and recklessly defaming us.
I see.
So, Martyr said, what can we do? Can we prevent them from running the story?
No.
Can we get a court injunction barring them?
No, that's prior restraint, and from a publicity standpoint, that's ill-advised.
You mean it'd look bad?
An attempt to muzzle the press? Violate the First Amendment? That would suggest you have something to hide.
In other words, Martyr said, they can run the story and we are powerless to stop them.
Yes.
Okay, but I think Newsline's information is inaccurate and biased. Can we demand they give equal time to our evidence?
No, Fuller said.
The Fairness Doctrine, which included the equal time provision, was scrapped under Reagan. Television news programs are under no obligation to present all sides of an issue.
So they can say anything they want, no matter how unbalanced.
That's right.
That doesn't seem proper.
It's the law, Fuller said with a shrug.
Okay, Martyr said.
Now, this program is going to air at a very sensitive moment for our company. Adverse publicity may very well cost us the China sale.
Yes, it might.
Suppose we lost business as a result of this show. If we can demonstrate that Newsline presented an erroneous view and we told them it was erroneous, can we sue them for damages?
As a practical matter, no. We would probably have to show they proceeded with reckless disregard for the facts known to them. Historically, that has been extremely difficult to prove.
So, Newsline is not liable for damages?
Nope.
They can say whatever they want, and if they put us out of business, it's our tough luck?
That's correct.
Is there any restraint at all on what they say?
Well, Fuller shifted in the chair. If they falsely portrayed the company, they might be liable, but in this instance we have a lawsuit brought by an attorney for a passenger on 545. So Newsline is able to say they're just reporting the facts, that an attorney has made the following accusations about us.
I understand, Martyr said. But a claim filed in a court has limited publicity. Newsline is going to present these crazy claims to 40 million viewers. And at the same time, they'll automatically validate the claims simply by repeating them on television. The damage to us comes from their exposure, not from the original claims.
I take your point, Fuller said. But the law doesn't see it that way. Newsline has the right to report a lawsuit.
Newsline has no responsibility to independently assess the legal claims being made, no matter how outrageous. If the lawyer said, for example, that we employed child molesters, Newsline could still report that with no liability to themselves?
Correct.
Let's say we go to trial and win. It's clear that Newsline presented an erroneous view of our product based on the attorney's allegations, which have been thrown out of court. Is Newsline obligated to retract the statements they made to 40 million viewers?
No, they have no such obligation.
Why not?
Newsline can decide what's newsworthy. If they think the outcome of the trial is not newsworthy, they don't have to report it. It's their call.
And meanwhile, the company is bankrupt, Martyr said. 30,000 employees lose their jobs, houses, health benefits, and start new careers at Burger King? And another 50,000 lose their jobs when our suppliers go belly up in Georgia, Ohio, Texas, and Connecticut. All those fine people who devoted their lives working to design, build, and support the best airframe in the business get a firm handshake and a swift kick in the butt. Is that how it works?
Fuller shrugged.
That's how the system works, yes. I'd say the system sucks.
The system is the system. Fuller said.
Martyr glanced at Casey, then turned back to Fuller. Now, Ed, he said, this situation sounds very lopsided. We make a superb product, and all the objective measures of its performance demonstrate that it's safe and reliable. We've spent years developing and testing it. We've got an irrefutable track record. But you're saying a television crew can come in, hang around a day or two, and trash our product on national TV. And when they do, they have no responsibility for their acts, and we have no way to recover damages.
Fuller nodded.
Pretty lopsided, Martyr said.
Fuller cleared his throat.
Well, it wasn't always that way. But for the last 30 years, since Sullivan in 1964, the First Amendment has been invoked in defamation cases. Now the press has a lot more breathing room.
Including room for abuse, Martyr said.
Fuller shrugged. Press abuse is an old complaint, he said. Just a few years after the First Amendment was passed, Thomas Jefferson complained about how inaccurate the press was, how unfair.
But Ed, Martyr said.
We're not talking about 200 years ago. And we're not talking about a few nasty editorials in colonial newspapers. We're talking about a television show with compelling images that goes instantaneously to 40, 50 million people, a sizable percentage of the whole country, and murders our reputation, murders it, unjustifiably. That's the situation we're talking about here. So, Martyr said,
what do you advise us to do, Ed?
Well, Fuller cleared his throat again, I always advise my clients to tell the truth.
That's fine, Ed. That's sound counsel. But what do we do?
It would be best, he said, if you were prepared to explain what occurred on Flight 545.
It happened 4 days ago. We don't have a finding yet.
Fuller said, it would be best if you did. After Fuller had left, Marta turned to Casey. He didn't say anything. He just looked at her. Casey stood there for a moment. She understood what Marta and the lawyer were doing. It had been a very effective performance. But the lawyer was also right, she thought. It would be best if they could tell the truth and explain the flight. As she listened to him, she had begun to think that somehow she might find a way to tell the truth, or enough of the truth, to make this work. There were enough loose ends, enough uncertainties that she might pull them together to form a coherent story.
All right, John, she said. I'll do the interview.
Excellent, Marta said, smiling and rubbing his hands together. I knew you'd do the right thing, Casey. Newsline has scheduled a slot at 4 p.m. tomorrow. Meantime, I want you to work briefly with a media consultant, someone from outside the company.
John, she said, I'll do it my way.
She's a very nice woman.
I'm sorry, Casey said. I don't have time.
She can help you, Casey, give you a few pointers.
John, she said, I have work to do. And she left the room.
Digital Data Center, 6:15 p.m. She had not promised to say what Marta wanted her to say. She had only promised to do the interview. She had less than 24 hours to make significant progress in the investigation. She was not so foolish as to imagine she could determine what had happened in that time, but she could find something to tell the reporter. There were still many dangling leads. The possible problem with the locking pin, the possible problem with the proximity sensor, the possible interview with the first officer in Vancouver, the videotape at Video Imaging, the translation Ellen Fong was doing, the fact that the slats had deployed, but had been stowed immediately afterward. What exactly did that mean? Still so much to check.
I know you need the data, Rob Wong said, spinning his chair. I know, believe me.
He was in the digital display room in front of the screens filled with data.
But what do you expect me to do?
Rob, Casey said, the slats deployed. I have to know why, and what else happened on the flight. I can't figure it out without the flight recorder data.
In that case, Wong said, you better face the facts. We've been recalibrating all the 120 hours of data. The first 97 hours are okay. The last 23 hours are anomalous.
I'm only interested in the last 3 hours.
I understand, Wong said. But to recalibrate those 3 hours, we have to go back to where the bus blew and work forward. We have to calibrate 23 hours of data, and it's taking us about 2 minutes a frame to recalibrate.
She frowned. What are you telling me?
But she was already calculating it in her head.
2 minutes a frame means it'll take us 65 weeks.
That's more than a year.
Working 24 hours a day. Real world, it'd take us 3 years to generate the data.
Rob, we need this now.
It just can't be done, Casey. You're going to have to work this without the FDR. I'm sorry, Casey, that's the way it is.
She called accounting.
Is Ellen Fong there?
She didn't come in today. She said she was working at home.
Do you have her number?
Sure, the woman said, but she won't be there. She had to go to a formal dinner, some charity thing with her husband.
Tell her I called, Casey said.
She called Video Imaging in Glendale, the company that was working on the videotape for her. She asked for Scott Harmon.
Scott's gone for the day. He'll be in at 9 tomorrow morning.
She called Steve Nieto, the Pfizer in Vancouver, and got his secretary.
Steve's not here, she said. He had to leave early, but I know he wanted to talk to you. He said he had bad news.
Casey sighed. That seemed to be the only kind of news she was getting.
Can you reach him?
Not until tomorrow.
Tell him I called.
Her cell phone rang. Jesus, that Benson is unpleasant, Richmond said. What's his problem? I thought he was going to hit me.
Where are you?
At the office. Want me to come to you?
No, Casey said. It's after 6. You're done for the day.
But
see you tomorrow, Bob.
And she hung up.
On the way out of Hangar 5, she saw the electrical crews rigging TPA 545 for the CET that night. The entire aircraft had been raised 10 feet into the air and now rested on heavy blue metal fixtures beneath each wing, and fore and aft on the fuselage. The crews had then slung back safety webbing beneath the underside of the aircraft, some 20 feet above the ground. All along the fuselage, doors and accessory panels were open, and electricians standing on the webbing were running cables from the junction boxes back to the main CET test console, a 6-foot square box that was placed in the center of the floor to one side of the aircraft. The cycle electrical test, as it was known, consisted of sending electrical impulses to all parts of the aircraft's electrical system. In rapid succession, every component was tested, everything from cabin lights to reading lights, cockpit display panels, engine ignition, and landing gear wheels. The full test cycle ran 2 hours. It would be repeated 12 times throughout the night. As she passed the console, she saw Teddy Rawley. He gave her a wave but didn't approach her. He was busy. Undoubtedly, he'd heard that flight test was scheduled 3 days from now, and he would want to be sure the electrical test was performed correctly. She waved to Teddy, but he had already turned away. Casey headed back to her office. Outside, it was growing dark, the sky a deep blue. She walked back toward administration, hearing the distant rush of takeoffs from Burbank Airport. On the way, she saw Amos Peters shuffling toward his car, carrying a stack of papers under his arm. He looked back and saw her.
Hey, Casey.
Hi, Amos.
He dropped his papers with a thud on the roof of his car, bent to unlock the door.
I hear they're putting the screws to you.
Yeah.
She was not surprised, he knew. The whole plant probably knew by now. It was one of the first things she had learned at Norton. Everyone knew everything minutes after it happened.
You gonna do the interview?
I said I would.
You gonna say what they want you to say?
She shrugged.
Don't get high and mighty, he said. These are television people. They're beneath pond scum on the evolutionary scale. Just lie. Hell with it.
We'll see.
He sighed.
You're old enough to know how it works, he said. You going home now?
Not for a while.
I wouldn't be hanging around the planet night, Casey.
Why not?
People are upset, Amos said. Next few days, it'd be better to go home early, you know what I mean?
I'll bear it in mind.
Do that, Casey. I mean it.
He got in his car and drove off. QA, 7:20 p.m. Norma was gone. The QA office was deserted. The cleaning crews had already started in the back offices. She heard a tinny portable radio playing Run, Baby, Run. Casey went to the coffee maker, poured a cup of cold coffee, and took it into her own office. She flicked on the lights, stared at the stack of papers waiting on her desk. She sat down and tried not to be discouraged by the way things were going. She had 20 hours until the interview, and her leads were falling apart. Just lie. Hell with it. She sighed.
Maybe Amos was right.
She stared at the papers, pushing aside the picture of John Chang and his smiling family. She didn't know what to do except go through the papers and check. She again came to the charts of the flight plan. Again, they teased her. She remembered she had had an idea just before Marta called her the night before. She had a feeling. But what was it? Whatever it was gone now. She set the flight plan aside, including the general declaration, outward, inward, that had been filed with it, which listed the crew. John Zen Chang, Captain, May 7, 1951, male. Lu Zong Ping, First Officer, March 11, 1959, male. Richard Yong, First Officer,
September 9th, 1961, male. Gerhard Ryman, first officer. July 7th, 1949, male. Thomas Chang, first officer. June 29th, 1970, male. Henri Marchand, engineer. April 25th, 1969, male. Robert Sheng, engineer. June 13th, 1962, male. She paused, sipped the cold coffee. There was something odd about the list, she thought. Something obvious right in front of her face. But she couldn't put her finger on it. She set the list aside. Next, a transcript of communications from Southern California Air Traffic Approach Control. As usual, it was printed without punctuation, the transmission to 545 intermixed with transmissions to several other aircraft. 0543 and 12 seconds.
365, ground 35,000.
And 14 seconds.
On frequency again, changed radio, sorry about that.
And 15 seconds.
198, copy.
And 19 seconds.
Fuel remaining, 4201.
And 22 seconds.
Copy that, 2585, no problem, we have you now.
And 23 seconds.
This is Trans-Pacific 545, we have an emergency.
And 26 seconds.
Affirmative, 001.
And 29 seconds.
Go ahead, 545.
And 31 seconds.
Request priority clearance for emergency landing in Los Angeles.
And 32 seconds.
Down to 29,000.
And 35 seconds.
Okay, 545, understand you request priority clearance to land.
And 40 seconds.
Affirmative.
And 41 seconds.
Say the nature of your emergency.
And 42 seconds.
321, ground 32,000.
And 55 seconds.
Holding 269.
0544 and 5 seconds.
We have a passenger emergency. We need ambulances on the ground. I would say 30 or 40 ambulances, maybe more.
And 10 seconds.
TPA 545, say again, are you asking for 40 ambulances?
And 27 seconds.
Turn 124.9er.
And 35 seconds.
Affirmative. We encountered severe turbulence during flight. We have injuries of passengers and flight crew.
And 48 seconds.
Copy 198. Good day.
And 50 seconds.
Trans-Pacific, I copy your ground request for 40 ambulances.
And 52 seconds.
Thank you.
Casey puzzled over the exchanges because they suggested very erratic behavior by the pilot. For example, the Trans-Pacific incident had occurred shortly after 5 in the morning. At that time, the plane was still in radio contact with Honolulu A-Ring. With so many injuries, the captain could have reported an emergency to Honolulu, but he hadn't done that. Why not? Instead, the pilot continued to Los Angeles, and he had waited until he was about to land before reporting an emergency. Why had he waited so long? And why would he say the incident had been caused by turbulence? He knew that wasn't true. The captain had told the stewardess the slats deployed, and she knew from Ziegler's audio that the slats had deployed. So why hadn't the pilot announced it? Why lie to approach control? Everyone agreed John Chang was a good pilot. So what was the explanation for his behavior? Was he in shock? Even the best pilots sometimes behave oddly in a crisis. But there seemed to be a pattern here, almost a plan. She looked ahead. 0544 and 59 seconds.
Do you need medical personnel, too? What is the nature of the injuries you're bringing in?
And 10 seconds.
I am not sure.
And 20 seconds.
Can you give us an estimate?
And 30 seconds.
I am sorry, no, an estimate is not possible.
And 32 seconds.
21929 clear.
And 35 seconds.
Is anyone unconscious?
And 40 seconds.
No, I do not think so, but two are dead.
The captain seemed to report the fatalities as an afterthought. What was really going on?
And 43 seconds.
Copy, 001.
And 51 seconds. TPA 545, what is the condition of your aircraft? And 58 seconds.
We have damage to passenger cabin. Minor damage only.
Casey thought, minor damage only? That cabin had sustained millions of dollars of damage. Hadn't the captain gone back to look for himself? Did he not know the extent of the damage? Why would he say what he did?
0546 and 12 seconds.
What is the condition of the flight deck?
And 22 seconds.
Flight deck is operational. FDAU is nominal.
And 31 seconds.
Copy that, 545. What is the condition of your flight crew?
And 38 seconds.
Captain and first officer in good condition.
At that moment, one of the first officers had been covered in blood. Again, did the pilot not know? She glanced at the rest of the transcript, then pushed it aside. She'd show it to Felix tomorrow and get his opinion. She went on, looking through the structure reports, the interior cabin reports, the relevant PMA records for the counterfeit slats locking pin and the counterfeit thruster cowl. Steadily, patiently, she worked on into the night. It was after 10 o'clock when she again turned to the faults printout from Flight 545. She had been hoping she could skip this and use the flight recorder data instead, but now there was nothing to do but slog through it. Yawning, tired, she stared at the columns of numbers on the first page. She didn't want to do this. She hadn't eaten dinner yet, and she knew she should eat. Anyway, the only questions she had about these fault listings were the AUX readings. She had asked Ron, and he had said the first was the auxiliary power unit. The second and third were unused, and the fourth, AUX COA, was a customer-installed line. But there wasn't anything on those lines, Ron said, because a zero reading was normal. It was the default reading. So she was really finished with this listing. She was done. Casey stood up at her desk, stretched, looked at her watch. It was 10:15. She'd better get some sleep, she thought. After all, she was going to appear on television tomorrow. She didn't want her mother to call afterward saying, "Dear, you looked so tired." Casey folded up the printout and put it away. Zero, she thought, was the perfect default value, because that was what she was coming up with on this particular night's work. A big zero. Nothing. "A big fat zero," she said aloud, "means nothing on the line." She didn't want to think what that meant, that time was running out, that her plan to push the investigation had failed and that she was going to end up in front of a television camera tomorrow afternoon with the famous Marty Reardon asking her questions, and she would have no good answers to give him, except the answers that John Martyr wanted her to give. Just lie. Hell with it. Maybe that was how it was going to turn out.
"You're old enough to know how it works."
Casey turned out her desk light and started for the door. She said goodnight to Esther, the cleaning woman, and went out into the hallway. She got into the elevator, pushed the button to go down to the ground floor. The button lit up when she touched it, glowing 1. She yawned as the door started to close. She was really very tired. It was silly to work this late. She'd make foolish mistakes, overlook things. She was looking at the glowing button. And then it hit her.
"Forget something?" Esther said as Casey came back into the office.
"No," Casey said. She rifled through the sheets on her desk, fast, searching, tossing the papers in all directions, letting them flutter to the floor. Ron had said the default was zero, and therefore when you got a zero, you didn't know if the line was used or not. But if there was a one, then that would mean... She found the listing, ran her finger down the columns of numbers. There was a numeral 1. AUX COA had registered a fault on the second leg of the flight. That meant the AUX COA line was being used by the aircraft. But what was it used for? She sucked in her breath. She hardly dared to hope. Ron said that AUX COA was a line for customer optional additions.
The customer used it for add-ons like a QAR. The QAR was the Quick Access Recorder, another flight data recorder, installed to help the maintenance crews. It recorded many of the same parameters as a regular DFDR. If a QAR was on this aircraft, it could solve all her problems. But Ron insisted this plane didn't have a QAR. He said he'd looked in the tail, which was where it was usually installed on an N-22, and it wasn't there. Had he ever looked anywhere else? Had he really searched the plane? Because Casey knew an optional item like the QAR was not subject to FAA regulation, it could be any place in the aircraft the operator wanted it, in the aft accessory compartment, or the cargo hold, or the radio rack beneath the cockpit. It could be just about anywhere. Had Ron really looked? She decided to check for herself. She spent the next 10 minutes thumbing through the thick service repair manuals for the N-22 without any success. The manuals didn't mention the QAR at all, or at least she couldn't find any reference. But the manuals she kept in her office were personal copies. Casey wasn't directly involved in maintenance, and she didn't have the latest versions. Most of the manuals dated back to her own arrival at the company. They were 5 years old. That was when she noticed the heads-up display sitting on her desk. Wait a minute, she thought. She grabbed the goggles, slipped them on. She plugged them into the CD player. She pressed the power switch. Nothing happened. She fiddled with the equipment for a few moments until she realized there was no CD-ROM in the machine. She looked in the cardboard box, found a silver platter, and slid it into the player. She pressed the power button again. The goggles glowed. She was staring at a page from the first maintenance manual projected onto the inside of the goggles. She wasn't quite sure how the system worked, because the goggles were just an inch from her eyes, but the projected page appeared to float in space, 2 feet in front of her. The page was almost transparent. She could see right through it. Corman liked to say that virtual reality was virtually useless, except for a few specialized applications. One was maintenance. Busy people working in technical environments, people who had their hands full or covered in grease, didn't have the time or inclination to look through a thick manual. If you were 30 feet up in the air trying to repair a jet engine, you couldn't carry a stack of 5-pound manuals around with you. So virtual displays were perfect for those situations, and Corman had built one. By pressing buttons on the CD player, Casey found that she could scroll through the manuals. There was also a search function that flashed up a keyboard hanging in space. She had to repeatedly press another button to move a pointer to the letter Q, then A, then R. It was clumsy, but it worked. After a moment of worrying, a page hung in the air before her. N-22, Quick Access Recorder, Recommended Locations. Pressing more buttons, she scrolled through a sequence of diagrams showing in detail all the places where the QAR could be located on the N-22 aircraft. There were about 30 places in all. Casey clipped the player onto her belt and headed for the door. Airport Marina, 10:20 p.m. Marty Reardon was still in Seattle. His interview with Gates had run long and he'd missed his plane. Now he was coming down in the morning. Jennifer had to revise the schedule. It was going to be a difficult day, she realized. She'd hoped to start at 9. Now she couldn't begin until 10 at the earliest. She sat in the hotel room with her laptop, figuring it out. 9 to 10, transfer from LAX. 10 to 10:45, Barker at office. 11 to 11:30, King at airport. 11:30 to 12, FAA at airport. 12:15 to 1:45, transfer to Burbank. 2 to 2:30, Rogers at Burbank. 2:30 to 3:30, stand up outside Norton. 4 to 4:30, Singleton at Norton. 4:30 to 6, transfer to LAX. Too tight. No time for lunch, for traffic delays, for normal production screw-ups. And tomorrow was Friday. Marty would want to make the 6 o'clock plane back to New York. Marty had a new girlfriend, and he liked to spend the weekend with her. Marty would be very pissy if he missed the flight. And he was definitely going to miss it.
The problem was that by the time Marty finished with Singleton and Burbank, it would be rush hour. He'd never make his plane. He really should leave Burbank by 2:30, which meant pushing Singleton up and holding off the lawyer. She was afraid she'd lose the FAA guy if she changed him at the last minute. But the lawyer would be flexible. He'd wait until midnight if they asked him to. She'd talked with the lawyer earlier. King was a blowhard, but he was plausible in short bites. 5-10 seconds. Punchy. Worth doing.
9 to 10, transfer from LAX. 10 to 10:45, Barker at office. 11 to 11:30, FAA at airport. 11:30 to 12:30, transfer to Burbank. 12:30 to 1, Rogers at Burbank. 1 to 2, stand-up outside Norton. 2 to 2:30, Singleton at Norton. 2:30 to 4, transfer to LAX. 4 to 4:30, King at airport. 5 to 6, pad.
That would work. In her mind, she reviewed her pullouts. If the FAA guy was good, Jennifer hadn't met him yet, just talked on the phone, then Marty might run over with him. If it took too long to transfer to Burbank, she'd blow off Rogers, who was weak anyway, and go right to Marty's stand-up. Singleton would be fast. Jennifer wanted to keep Marty moving there so she didn't attack the woman too much. A tight schedule would help. Back to LAX, finish with King. Marty'd leave at 6, and Jennifer would have her tape. She'd go to an editing bay at the O&O, cut the segment, and uplink to New York that night. She'd call in and get Dick's comment Saturday morning, revise it, and uplink it again about noon. That was plenty of time to make air. She made a note to call Norton in the morning and tell them she needed to move Singleton up 2 hours. Finally, she turned to the stack of faxed background documents Norton had sent her office for Deborah's research. Jennifer had never bothered to look at these, and she wouldn't bother now, except she had nothing better to do. She thumbed through them quickly. It was what she expected. Self-justifying papers that said the N-22 was safe, that it had an excellent record. Flipping from page to page, she suddenly stopped. She stared. "They've got to be kidding," she said, and she closed the file. Hangar 5, 10:30 p.m. At night, the Norton plant appeared deserted, the parking lots nearly empty, the perimeter buildings silent, but it was brightly lit. Security kept floodlights on all night, and there were video monitors mounted on the corners of all the buildings. As she crossed from administration to Hangar 5, she heard her footsteps clicking on the asphalt. The big doors to Hangar 5 were pulled down and locked. She saw Teddy Rawley standing outside talking to one of the electrical team. A wisp of cigarette smoke rose up toward the floodlights. She went over to the side door. "Hey, babe," Teddy said. "Still here, huh?"
"Yeah,"
she said. She started through the door. The electrical guy said, "The building's closed. Nobody's allowed in. We're doing the CET now."
"It's okay," she said.
"I'm sorry you can't," the guy said. "Ron Smith gave strict orders. Nobody's to go inside. If you touch anything on the airplane..."
"I'll be careful," she said.
Teddy looked at her, walked over. "I know you will," he said, "but you're going to need this." He handed her a heavy flashlight, 3 feet long. "It's dark in there, remember?" The electrical guy said, "And you can't turn the lights on. We can't have change in the ambient flux." "I understand," she said. The test equipment was sensitive. Turning on the overhead fluorescence might change readings. The electrician was still fretting. "Maybe I better call Ron and tell him you're going in."
"Call whoever you want," Casey said.
"And don't touch the handrails because..."
"I won't," she said.
"For Christ's sake, I know what I'm doing." She went into the hangar. Teddy was right. It was dark inside. She felt, rather than saw, the large space around her. She could barely discern the outlines of the plane looming above her. All its doors and compartments were open, cable hanging down everywhere. Beneath the tail, the test box sat in a pool of faint blue light. The CRT screen flickered as systems were activated in sequence. She saw the cockpit lights go on, then off, then the forward cabin lights brightly lit 30 feet above her, then darkness again. A moment later, the beacon lights on the wingtips and the tail came on, sending hot white strobe flashes through the room, then darkness again. The front headlights suddenly glared brightly from the wing, and the landing gear began to retract. Because the